Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. The time is 7 minutes after 9 a.m., April 6, 2012. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman. Senator Ellis, Senator Olson will be arriving shortly. Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, and Senator McGuire should be arriving sometime. We have one bill on the agenda today, Senate Bill 192, Oil and Gas Production. Today we are taking invited testimony from the administration and the industry. This morning we'll hear from the Department of Revenue, the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and BP. This afternoon we'll hear from ConocoPhillips and Exxon. Before we start the invited testimony, we need to adopt another committee substitute. We had a drafting glitch yesterday that some people got enthusiastic about, but it was an error. Senator Hoffman, we have a motion to adopt committee substitute version U.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 192 /U as our working document.
And I will object for explanation and ask Mr. Peterson to come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff to the Senate Finance Committee. Version U has three changes in it. Start on page 4, section 3. This section of statute, AS 4355-011G, is the section of statute which now sets up the three different tax rates for the three different types of production. There was some concern yesterday that the way that it was drafted would have allowed a producer to access the intermediate tax level if any production in a field was above the target volume decline curve. So we redrafted that page 4, lines 19 through 25. This section defines what's existing production. We made it just very clear that all existing production, whether the producer is able to increase production above their target volume or not, all existing production below that target volume will be taxed at the high progressivity rate. Page 5, lines 8 through 13, this section defines what production is incremental above the target volume decline rate. And we redrafted that to also make it very clear that any production above that target volume will be taxed at the intermediate progressivity rate, but all the remaining production below the target volume will still be taxed at the higher progressivity rate. The third change, Mr. Chairman, starts on page 6, line 31, through page 7, line 8. And this is new language that was inserted to specify that a company that is involved in a merger or an acquisition of another company cannot use that company's production to increase their production above the target volume decline rate. Those are all the changes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I'll go ahead and remove my objection to adoption of the new CS. Do we have any further objection to the adoption of the CS version U? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and adopt version U as our working document. With that, I'd like to apologize for the confusion yesterday that in the language of the bill. There was I wouldn't call it a drafting error, but just as we rushed to try to get things accomplished by the end of the session, there was a paragraph could have been written a little cleaner to make sure that everybody understands what the obligations are. With that, I'd like to go ahead and ask the Commissioner of Revenue to come forward. He can bring up his trusty aide, Mr. Tangeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. With me is the Deputy Commissioner for the Department, Bruce Tangeman. We have a fairly short presentation this morning, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, I would like to thank the committee's consultant, PFC Energy. We've had a very good relationship with Mr. Mayor, keeping our models, producing the same numbers, which is very important. And when the first CS came out earlier in the week And there was a discrepancy. He was willing to sit down with us and work through it, and it turned out to be an error in his model that was corrected and then corrected in the bill. So we really appreciated the working relationship. Mr. Chairman, today we will touch on version O and the changes that have come in this morning's testimony aren't included in here, but I think there may only be one comment on the slide that would be affected by the changes made. So virtually everything that we have presented is still specific and would be valid for this current CS that we have in front of us. We'll not go into detail about what is in the bill because this is the committee's bill. We'll just touch on what we see as the effect of the pieces of it. Questions?
Just hold it there, just for clarification for the public. Yesterday when we noticed the drafting glitch, we sent out an email probably within 15, 20 minutes of the meeting notifying the department and the presenters today that there was a correction coming in the language. So there would be no misunderstanding today, and people wouldn't be setting up for a presentation that would be too far off.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that is correct, and we incorporated that in. The one piece that I don't believe we had looked at was the language that would not allow an acquisition to be beneficial, and that was something that we had noted. So I think it might be in the presentation, but if it is, you've obviously dealt with the situation. The questions that we looked at as we worked on our version of an oil tax bill was, does the bill make Alaska more competitive? Does the bill make Alaska more appealing to potential investors? Does the bill make our tax structure less complicated and more understandable to investors? And are these changes meaningful enough to compete for investment capital? In taking a look at the change to progressivity calculation for currently producing fields, production from currently producing fields exceeding a production target and new fields, change to the minimum tax, lease expenditure allocation change, and the petroleum information management system are what we focused on for this presentation. What we see is the impact of change to progressivity on production tax liability. The tax is increased. It's company, very company specific. So, in particular, in dealing with lease expenditures. So, in general, the system is kept neutral at $100 a barrel, and taxes are increased at lower prices due to the gross minimum tax floor provisions being put in. However, there are companies that will see tax increases at $100 a barrel and under. And they're very company specific, so it has a wide variety of effects. And then the tax is a reduction, a small reduction for many companies above $100 a barrel. And as I mentioned before, tax changes will impact all companies differently. Currently, companies are allowed to use their lease expenditures to reduce their production tax value and therefore their progressive tax rate. This bill does not factor lease expenditures into the calculation of progressivity. Companies with higher lease expenditures could find this bill relatively less attractive because they can no longer use the expenditures to reduce their progressive tax. Companies with lower lease expenditures could find the bill relatively more attractive because they have less expenditures and would benefit from lower progressive tax. And we'll have a couple of graphs later on that will show the difference that we see between a company that is spending a lot of money to develop and a company that is spending a smaller amount of money to develop. The gross progressive tax could reduce the incentive to invest and reward companies in a harvest mode with low lease expenditures. However, we are aware that the new fields and new production from existing fields, progressivity aspects of it could help balance that out.
Are you going to, I guess in your presentation, I guess we're going to be here on the minimum taxes. At some point, we need to drill down into the comments. So these are kind of overview comments, and then we're going to drop down?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The comments on the minimum tax, as the committee has discussed before, the provision would create a substantial tax increase at lower prices, generally $60 a barrel and under. The minimum tax wouldn't impact any companies at the current prices. It would be at lower prices. And if oil prices were to drop to $60 a barrel and lower, state revenues from oil would be less than half their current level. So even a tax increase would only have a minimal benefit to the state. There would still be substantial budget decisions that would have to be made as a result of the low price of oil.
So do we want to stop there and talk about this minimum tax, or how's your, because I haven't had a chance to look at your presentation. At some point, we need to talk about these items.
Yeah, we have two more slides talking about the Petroleum Information Management System, and then we get into the slides that we have graphed out the tax rates. And that might be the appropriate time. However, we'd be happy to talk about it at any point.
Let's go ahead and finish up your walkthrough till we get to the slides, but we need to talk about each one of these items.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
A Petroleum Information Management System requires the department to have an information management system in place by January 1st of 2014. In our opinion, this competes with the core mission of the tax division, which is to assess and collect taxes. It competes with daily staff goals of interacting with taxpayers, forecasting revenues, and auditing tax returns. And it would likely see a delay in much of the other business that the tax division does as a result of this. Throughout the session, the department's been taken to task for not having been able to provide the legislature with information quickly enough without being able to catch up on our audits. And this bill would now task us with rewriting regulations, implementing a new tax, and implementing a public, new public information management system that would likely cost millions of dollars and quite a number of positions, at the same time that we are trying to implement a $35 million database system to get our tax database working at a higher level than we've been dealing with previously. Much of the information being asked for in this management system is already gathered by DNR, AOGCC, Department of Labor, and Department of Revenue. In fact, to the degree the Department of Revenue has any involvement in this, most of our information is confidential, and we are asked to gather all of this information from other departments, which I have to say would be much more difficult to our tax division given all of the other responsibilities and challenges that we have. Millions of data elements would have to be manually uploaded to the system in various formats, including electronic copies of Excel spreadsheets, PDFs, Word documents, hard copies. Determination would have to be made as to the confidentiality of each item for uploading to the system, which would take thousands of employee hours. And as I mentioned, the department's currently only begun dealing with the tax revenue management system, which is going to take 2 to 5 years for us to implement, even not taking on this additional challenge. We're concerned that this would delay the implementation of that important tax-specific project and would require significant funding and staff resources to the department. Spending millions of dollars to compile information that's already available to the various departments does not seem to us to be a wise use of state resources.
And for the record, Bruce Tangeman, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. As we go, eventually as we go through the graphs, I'd like to point out that what's on the screen is correct. Apparently, it appears that some of the printed copies may have been double printed, or there's more lines on there than should be. So it appears the version online is correct and the one on the screen is correct. So if you're seeing double lines, those are incorrect and we'll get corrected copies over.
On slide 10, Mr. Chairman, shows just kind of a different version of what you've already seen from PFC Energy. The black line is current law, ACES, going between $40 and $200. The red line is HB 110, the governor's bill, just for a frame of reference. And the blue line is CS of SB 192. As you can see on it, from $60 a barrel below, this would be a significant tax increase from current law. From about $60 to about $110, it's virtually the same. And as we get up over primarily the numbers that historically we've never seen, we begin to see more of a tax decrease.
If we can just stop there. Just looking through the presentation, it appears that there's no, we're dealing with effective tax rates pretty much throughout the presentation. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of public discussion of marginal tax rates. I think the legislation in front of us makes a substantial shift away from the marginal tax concern, and also the impact or the exposure the state has having potentially in the federal government up to 100% and even over on financial help and dealing with capital expenditures, putting the state in a position where we could incentivize behavior that's not in our interest, because we would in effect have the industry would have a zero capital cost on the net. And so I'm just kind of curious why that is missing, and then I'll have some, we'll have some discussion on this slide.
Chairman, the marginal graphs that we've seen, and again, we could have included a lot more, but under the short timeline, we wanted to limit the exposure today. The marginal graphs that we're looking at do show a slight improvement on the marginal side, but not nearly the change that the bracketed system that we had been working with under the governor's bill would alleviate. So it does affect it a little bit, but not as much as a bracketed system would.
So when you go from a 90% marginal tax rate to a 45% marginal tax rate, that is barely measurable by your definition?
Chairman, we'll be more than happy to show the graphs, but I'm not prepared to talk about the exact.
And Mr. Chairman, that's certainly information.
I would just remind you that we've been in this game for several years, and to be careful what you tell us, because if you tell us that significant change is inconsequential, as you can see, we have members here that sort of, you know, think it's humorous. So let's try to be a little accurate in our discussion.
Mr. Chairman, we're not saying it's inconsequential, and we're happy to get the committee those copies. However, we got the CS at about 3:30 yesterday afternoon. We were here quite late last night just to produce what we have in front of us, and we worked with effective because we've been told repeatedly effective was a more well-rounded view of what we were dealing with than all the rest. So we would be happy to do it, but our focus was on effective tax rates because that's simply what we had the time to.
Right. Let me just clarify my statement, because I didn't mean to be, to make a comment on the effective, because it is the effective rate is the issue in front of us we're trying to deal with. The marginal rate is a challenge within the current system. I think most of us would agree at high rates, but it's the inference that going from a 90% roughly marginal tax rate to somewhere in the range of 45 is insignificant. So we'll clarify that later and deal with that stuff, but just choose your words carefully.
If one of us said insignificant, Mr. Chairman, we misspoke.
Okay. So back to the effective rate. We've had a lot of testimony here. Just a second.
Go ahead.
Pardon me? Senator Hoffman?
I want to comment on this slide later on.
No, I haven't even started this slide yet. Okay. We've had a lot of testimony here over the period of time that the fiscal system we have is good for a harvest mode environment, and the problems really is appearing north of $100, and we should really be looking at trying to repair our system or make adjustments north of $100. So with that in mind, you know, the committee's bill here roughly has a small impact, or not too small, with the floor, and it's represented here in a chart with the blue line going up in the event we get to a $50 to a $40 range in oil. And at that time, I think we'd all be sitting at this table trying to figure out what we're going to do if that was to be extended over a long period of time. But if we go up to the $100 range, where the committee started spending a lot of their time north of $100 range, we have roughly, on the state, take roughly a 50 million rounded off impact. But HB 110 has a $1.1 billion impact to the state. So what can you tell the committee that would assure them that we should be changing from a 50%, or excuse me, a $50 million impact to the state at $100 to a $1.1 billion when our consultants have repeatedly told us that it is not needed?
Mr. Chairman, I respectfully disagree with your consultants. We have the highest tax rate in North America. We've got one of the highest in any OECD country, state, or province at $100. And we believe that's a disincentive, and we think we're seeing it in the lack of production, lack of development, lack of investment going on in Alaska. I think that the difference between the two is more than a dollar amount. It's the difference between what companies are, how they're evaluating it, how they see it being a material difference, a material change, and how they see it changing their investment decisions based on it. And so I think, you know, I can't speak for the companies. You're going to hear from them yourselves. But that's the significant difference that we see, more than just the dollar amount.
I guess the companies will speak for themselves, but as I recall their testimony, their concern has been reflected to us as north of 100 also. So that is another reason why the committee spent a lot of their effort north of $100, and the issue dealing with how do you fix the ever increasing share to the state, splitting a profit oil, and it really got exaggerated in the charts. You know, when you look out at like $200. But Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at the chart, you know, I think that, you know, the y-axis, it would be better portrayed if it was in dollars instead of percentages, because I think that is a little bit, you know, in my statistics class when I was in college, you know, you could sort of use graphs to exaggerate the points you want to make. And one of the reasons that and the cash to the companies at $40 would be a reduction of $194 million, and then at $100 it's negligible. But when you get up to $150, we're looking at cash to the companies of two-thirds of $1 billion, and then you go north of that to $170, cash to the companies is in excess of $1 billion. And if you go to $200, it's $1.75 billion to the cash to the companies. And I think when they do their modeling for investments, you know, those are the numbers that they're going to be looking at. And part of the thought process I think that this committee had was that if we're going to give make substantial changes to the formula at the high end, we should have some sort of protection at the low end, and that is the reason for the differences. But when you compare the 194 million to the potential of another billion at 170, you know, I think that is a very significant. The other point is that maybe we would get the testimony that what are the probabilities of $170 a barrel? You know, they may be low, but then again, the We've had our consultants say that the probabilities of $40 a barrel are very low as well. And as the chairman said, if they go down to $40 a barrel, the people at the finance committees are going to be scrambling anyway. So I think that the concept was if we give on the high end, we should have some protections on the low end, and that is the reason. But that chart, you know, shows it going up 100%. But when you look at it in dollars, the number, the graph wouldn't be as drastic. That is the point that I would like to make, Mr. Chairman.
And just one other thing before he answers it, just to put it in context, roughly that the delta in dollars between the black line, you know, where the green line intersects, and the blue is $765 million. It's a total from the black line to the red line of about $2.784 billion. So the delta between the blue and the red is $2 billion. These are significant amounts of money, just for the committee to keep in mind what we're actually looking at in dollars. And if you could help Senator Hoffman with his question, please.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. Taking a look at the dollars is certainly a worthwhile endeavor. The reason we have percentages up here is because keeping the transportation OPEX and CAPEX numbers constant for any situation, these would apply for any year. They would apply in any different scenario, not specifically this scenario. So it gives you more of a snapshot into the future than it would looking at today's dollars, which is important. It just doesn't give you as broad range of an idea of how this would impact the future that looking at tax rate percentages would.
Well, I guess, you know, going back to my classes in college on statistics, I think that the presentation that you're giving here on percentages probably more for the effect of shock value.
If we could just take a look at this chart and roughly where the blue line bends, which is the CS in front of us, is where we wanted to parallel the government take number, the percentage, keep the percent of profit oil evenly split, not a dollar divided by 50, but the percentage of the profit staying constant north of 100, and roughly 20 here looks like about 130 in your chart, just for explanation to the public watching why the blue line flattens out. Flattens out intentionally to hold that split constant, and flattens out to get away from the marginal tax impact that the state is faced with at high rates. So that the chart looks accurate in that regard. And the impact of the floor looks dramatic, but it's somewhere around $300 million to the state, and from where we're at now at $40. And the point that Senator Hoffman was bringing up, it's an increase to the state at $340 if we had a $40 price range. And at $120, we're giving up about $277 million. The magnitude is fairly close, just swinging from one side of the table to the other. In other words, we give up $300 at $120, and we would get back, if the oil went down to $40, about $300. But the probability of hitting $40 and staying there without significant involvement with the state and the industry to rectify the situation at hand, I think, would be minimal. I can't imagine us running a $40 oil and the structure that we're under right now not being significantly altered to keep the industry alive and vibrant and the state functioning. I don't think either one of us can function under that scenario. Any other questions on this slide? Mr. Tangeman, you want to?
I'd like to make one quick comment. Not too long ago, we actually did see those swings from 40 to 140 in a short amount of time. So it's not unheard of. I understand what you're saying. Our department itself is projecting fairly flat prices into the near future, but those things have happened. We have realized them, and they certainly would have a serious impact on our budget. But I understand what you're saying, but we have seen those swings in a short amount.
And I'd agree with that, but not at sustained levels for quite some time. Price shocks downward, as we had the price shock upward at 145. Senator Hoffman.
They have happened, and that's why I think our our consultant said that it would be a very low, or I think his comments were a low probability.
I think we'll go on to the next slide. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for your presentation. I appreciate your comments on it, and I appreciate the use of the effective tax rate, although we always get back to the higher numbers, the 70-some percents and things like that, but I do appreciate that. But I did want to ask for just a clarification and an understanding. In PFC's proposal under tab 23, there's a revenue comparison, and it indicates on the bottom that, note, consistent with DOR methodology, these revenue numbers do not include payments for tax credits which are not claimed against current production, as these are accounted for separately in the budget. In 2013, DOR forecast a potential liability of $400 million for these credits, and I think my understanding of what he used was what had already been claimed, but not what was anticipated to be claimed, and I just wanted to make sure that I understood that correctly in relationship to your chart on your page 10, which indicates that the credits have been included, and if those were included or not, they anticipated.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Thomas, we also don't include the $400 million worth of credits that don't result in a tax liability for the companies, because it's accounted for, we're certainly aware of it, but it's not included in how the effective tax rates would work on who's currently paying taxes, because they're for companies right now that have no production and are not paying any taxes.
And the other just comment, I think, is, at one time people were predicting oil would be $150 a barrel, and we laughed at some of those predictions because oil was $30 or $40 a barrel, but it's not been that terribly long ago that situation of $30 a barrel oil existed, and here we are at 120 something now for ANS. So it's always hard to predict the future. We'd all be multimillionaires if we could. So I think that it's always good to be prepared for the future as well, and at least take a look at what could potentially be there. We're not all T. Boone Pickens folks, but I think he's probably more right than not. So.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Thomas, that's why we just plugged in. I mean, this is the same graph we've used for everything that we've done. We plugged in the numbers for the bill, and we wanted to have it around 40 to 200, and it's not likely we're going to see 40 in the next few years. It's not likely we're going to see 200, but we wanted to keep it within a realm that's reasonable in the future, so you can see how it looks like at every reasonable level of dollar amount, as opposed to ratcheting it down too much one direction or the other.
Just one last thing. So it would be reasonable, I would think you would believe that figuring a 10% increase, 10 to 15% increase in the price of oil over the next few years would be at least a reasonable process to be looking at?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, that is reasonable. However, the price of oil has never coincided with a normal inflation rate that you'd look at for growth of stock. I mean, we've gone from $30 oil to $15 oil over an extended period of time.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions on this slide, we'll quickly move on to slide number 11.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Slide 11, we graphed out what an effective tax rate would be for if a company currently producing were to increase their production 25% over the target. how that would affect their tax rate, what we'd be seeing in terms of a lower tax rate. So once again, black is current law, and blue is the bill, and then the dotted blue line would be what the company would be paying in a tax rate for that 25% over target.
And did you, a couple things, that, you know, if we're running roughly around 600,000 barrels a day and we go up 25%, we'd be at 750. We haven't spent a lot of time looking at the capital cost to get to 750. There's been discussion that it would take $3 to $5 billion a year, which is equivalent to an Uberuk and a Natiatuk, to basically level us out. So I don't know how much it would take to get to that 750 number, but I suppose we can ask and try to figure that out. Just take a brief at ease. He wants to, in their presentation, wants to stop for an at ease for Lifeline or take a breath, or they get too excited and we want to take an at ease. We'll just stop because we got the time. But the initial concern, and I know there's been comments in the press that it'd be nice to be at a million barrels a day. I think we'd all like to be at a million barrels a day for a whole lot of reasons. But just to get to 750 would be a monumental, and just to get to 600, I think, would surprise a lot of people, maintain our production at 600. So I guess with that, I'd like to hear what you have to say about that, and then I've got another kind of a question or comment.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. This slide, it just shows a conceptual percentage. It doesn't say, okay, we're at 600, what would we be at 750? This is just any company, whether they're at 80,000 or 150,000, what it would look like conceptually to increase the production and then factor in that lower tax rate to the entire tax they would pay.
Okay, fair enough. Because BP is roughly half our production in Prudhoe. Well, they're the operator there.
I'd like to add one thing. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I think it'll be interesting to hear from the companies when they present, because we agree that significant investment will need to take place in order to extract the resource. And we felt that the net system under ACES was an incentive, obviously. Now, we can talk about tax credits as a separate issue, obviously. Those are a separate issue that affect the tax. But by going to gross on the progressivity portion, we view that as more than likely a disincentive to investment at a time when we're going to need significant investment to extract those harder to get at hydrocarbons. We're not talking about easy oil. We're looking at heavy oil, viscous oil, shale oil, and those are going to be a lot more capital intensive. So,
well, I think that's a whole other topic to be discussed later, because I think you're going to find there's varying views on that, and particularly the issue of simplifying our tax code to incentivize heavy oil, viscous oil, or whatever, shale, whatever we're trying to target, and cost allocation issues. So we'll take up that discussion later on, but I think you're going to find that there's a difference of opinion as far as what makes things easier and what doesn't. But back on the slide here on production. So it's nice to see, the impact of a 25% increase. What we concentrated on was the cash flows and the net present value over the incremental production of a 10,000 barrel field. How do we move our tax code to incentivize, basically enhance the rate of return and the cash flows to the industry to get to their hurdle rates or closer to their hurdle rates so they would move on and do incremental projects that they're looking at right now? This doesn't really address that. I'm sure it's not meant to, but I'm just saying it. It's a piece, the effective tax rate of that, but to get to the core of it, you have to measure their cash flows and their rates of return. And I'm sure we'll be asking the industry that. They tell us that it's not enough or it's too much and that they want us to raise the issue. But with that, and it's also interesting for us to always look at, too, the effect of full credits, and I see you've referenced that on your slide, so I appreciate that, because sometimes the clarity isn't there without that reference. Any other questions on slide 11? Slide 12.
Slide 12 and 13, Mr. Chairman, I asked our modelers to factor in what the difference would be between a high-cost producer and a low-cost producer, using examples that, as we're looking, as Mr. Tangeman had mentioned, about economically challenged projects such as heavy shale, developments that are farther from infrastructure than we've previously had on the North Slope, that would be looking at a more cost, and in this case we estimated $20 a barrel for operating and $25 a barrel for capital expenses, expenditures, and then run a low cost of a company that would be in harvest mode, that would be putting just what they needed to do to continue producing where they are, to see how the bill affected that with the gross issue that's been included in here. And as you can see on slide 12, for a company that's a high cost and dealing with a more challenged field in which they're having to spend more money, it's a once again, current law is black and SB 192 is blue. You can see that it would be a considerable tax increase to a company trying to produce a high-cost development compared to current law.
I, what we've seen in our analysis under the high-cost arena, their present value numbers went up with our tax changes. So we'd have to go back and have this graph cross-referenced, because their economics improved, not got worse, over the life cycle of their investments for all the numbers we've seen here at the table, is my recollection. So we'll have to go back and because what you're looking at here is the effective tax rate, and what we're looking at is a life cycle economics, which is frankly more important. So I'd like to see how the life cycle economics work, because if we don't improve those over ACES, generally speaking, we're not improving the system. We're trying to move those numbers, and we had numerous presentations and charts presented to the committee with varying degrees of changes to progressivity and watching the impact of rates of return and net present values, trying to zero in on what we were going to put in the bill. So this is something that I think we need to work on together, because conceptually, it doesn't fit.
And we'd be happy to do that with you, Mr. Chairman. This is, as you know, we had a relatively short time frame to work on this, and this takes into account far fewer variables than trying to look at a life cycle of a field where you're having to come to a conclusion on a lot of different variables other than simply what would higher costs be. So that's mm-hmm. something that you fleshed out in this regime far greater than we have.
Obviously. And I'd like to add one other thing. The concept to remember when just looking at this graph alone is the black line takes into account deduction of all qualified capital and operating expenditures, 100%, which is what the current regime allows. The blue line, when you split it into a net system for the base and a gross system for the progressivity portion, as the price goes up, they're not allowed to take as many capital and operating lease expenditures against their taxes. So that's the main takeaway from this slide, is the black line allows 100% for capital and operating for the qualified lease expenditures. The blue line does not.
I think that goes back to that marginal rate issue a little bit, but it was pointed out by our consultants that in certain circumstances, having the progressivity on the gross and when you have a high-cost environment is somewhat of a disadvantage. But also, on the flip side of that, it puts downward pressure on the expenditure side as far as a direction possibly from the producer because of the effect. And one of the concerns that has been pointed out with our current system is the whole
high-cost expenditure side, not only the exposure to the state of having all these credits put to us, but the mechanics of the high tax structure and how it works. So we're trying to fix that. So it didn't go unnoticed or uncalculated.
And Chairman, we would agree that the tax credits that are being used to build that black line are certainly one of the many knobs that can be adjusted in any tax regime, but really ours, because we do have a lot of knobs to turn. But if you were to just adjust, work with the tax credit system within the existing infrastructure, you could certainly bend that black line to the way you see fit.
Okay. And then moving on to slide 13, Mr. Chairman, shows running it with $10 operating and $3 capital of trying to lay out what it would look like for a low-cost producer or a producer in harvest mode. And you, as you can see, there is a substantial tax reduction for that producer.
Okay. That's one of the things we're trying to accomplish, north of 120. Is to bring the tax rate down and actually starting to move north of 100. But again, we come back to one of the fundamental points that have been continually brought to our attention, is that below $100, there's a lack of need for incentive within our current producing basin, our legacy fields. And how do you justify moving roughly $1.1 billion to the industry when our consultants tell us that it's not justified? That is one of the things that we're struggling with. How do you do that?
Mr. Chairman, we once again respectfully disagree with that. We've got one of the highest tax rates of any OECD country. We're collecting a tremendous amount. We talk to companies that don't do business here, and they talk about that. It's more than just the companies here. So as we try to look at what we can do, I mean, even with the governor's bill, HB 110, we're still the highest tax rate in North America. So we're reducing our tax rate and we're taking in less revenue, but it's not a case where we're moving down to the low end. We're just moving it from up here to right here. And when you do talk about the dollar amount, you do talk about the tax rate, what factors into it is may get in increased investment, and which we need, obviously, in billions of dollars worth to get more production. And as a result, maybe there is a sweet spot somewhere between current law and where the governor's bill is, where we're reducing taxes, we're going to get more investment, and it's not exactly where the governor's line is. He has said, you know, he's willing to work on whatever's going to work, and we're going to hear from the companies. We haven't talked to the companies since the draft came out, so we don't know what they're going to say. But we think, in just our quick snapshot of this, that this discourages investment of higher cost, more challenged projects, and encourages harvest mode, and which is kind of the opposite direction that we were focusing on when we were working on our bill.
I think it's more accurate to say the current tax regime testimony has been it is effective if you want to operate under harvest mode. I think that's more accurate. I don't think we've had any testimony from our consultants saying what's on the table encourages harvest mode. We're moving away from that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just pointing out that under harvest mode, this is better than current law.
The bill in front of us, I agree. The just as a quick note, just so people following at home, because it's brought up a lot, the tax structure in Alaska versus North America. There's significant differences between state of Alaska being a subsurface owned in commons than any other jurisdiction in North America. We are not the same. We have different cost environments and a whole litany of other issues. So if it was as easy as comparing it straight across, we wouldn't be here. So that's not an accurate comparison, in my opinion. We must look more globally. We also have one, Prudhoe Bay is one of the most prolific oil basins in the world. There's been testimony that it's one of the top 10 in the world. So it's too narrow of a comparison. And as far as I can recall from PPT through ACES, we've never, ever limited our comparisons to North America. And I don't personally would ever agree to do that.
And Mr. Chairman, that's not what that's not what I was referring to. That is, however, something of value, because most of the companies that do business up here or potentially could do business up here have a North American focus. I think PFC Energy pointed out that Norway was the only OECD country or state or province above us, and $140 they dropped below us. So, you know, I could have used that as the example too. Right. That's just the point I was making, is that we are up high. It's a disincentive. That's what companies that do business here tell us. That's what companies that don't do business here tell us. And to make the goal focused very much on high oil prices that we may never see, without focusing on where we are today, which is high compared to just about anybody that we've compared to, I think is something that needs to be focused on. Another thing that factors into it is the high cost of doing business in Alaska. Mm-hmm. We're one of, if not the, one of the highest places for a company to actually do business, and that's a hurdle there's nothing we can do about, but it certainly plays into how competitive we are when compared with other jurisdictions.
Right, and just as a quick note, and then we'll go to Senator Hoffman. We intentionally modeled ACES and PPT against the North Sea. It's not by happenstance that we track Norway as close as we do. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Just a clarification, Mr. Chairman. Sure. When you had said that we have not discussed this particular version with the oil companies, are you referring to the administration?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I'm referring to myself. I and Mr. Mm-hmm. Tangeman, we haven't had any conversations with anybody since we got the draft. We've just been working on it internally.
Well, it sounded when you said we, it meant the administration. So thank you for that clarification.
So I would, looking at this chart, it looks like the version in front of us for low-cost producer enhances their economics from where we're currently at?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
And we look like we have a little peak spread somewhere around 130, and then the economics gets a little better, closer together, and further apart, or I guess closer together as you go north and south of 130 relative to the ununitized fields under HB 110.
Yeah, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And I think also that, if, has been mentioned, but our we don't in this bill ever get to the HB 110 and unitized fields. I think our incentive for the our incentives would get close to the unitized fields. It would get closer to the existing producers in the basin, what they would be paying under the HB 110, if that makes any sense. In other words, our incentives get close to where HB 110 is without incentives. I think if you run those, you'll see that they're pretty close. Okay, with that, any other questions on 13? Go on to 14.
Yeah, just in summary, Mr. Chairman, and I won't spend long on this because we've talked about most of the things. We see the change. We believe the changes move in the wrong direction. They benefit a company in harvest mode, and they appear to discourage higher investment, more challenged projects compared to current law. It makes one of the most complicated tax structures in the world even more complicated with the change from net to part net and part gross. And I can't emphasize this point enough. I'm very concerned about the additional burdens of a multi-million dollar database that the Department of Revenue would have to put together, consisting almost entirely of information that the Department of Revenue doesn't compile, being put on top of a department that is trying desperately to catch up with what's occurred over the previous 6 years in terms of 70-plus regulations, audits, and everything else in addition to a $35 million database system. We're doing the best we can. We're doing everything we need to do, and we are excited for the challenge, but this just, I can't tell you how the mood of our tax division folks were when we had our initial conversation about this, thinking about having to go through all of the regulations and putting together another huge multi-million dollar database.
And just to expand on that
just a second. So your testimony is this makes it worse than ACES? That's your testimony?
Specifically what, Mr. Chairman?
Well, earlier in your comment, I thought you said that the bill makes this worse.
This bill, in our opinion, is more complicated than ACES, given where we are today in terms of what we would have to administer and regulations we would have to be put in place. And also for high-cost projects, this appears to be worse than ACES in terms of the taxes that a company would have to pay because they don't have the benefits.
So if you could get back to the committee on the economics run on that? Because our economic runs are different than that, and show it not so much the tax rate. I want to see the full cycle economics, because that's the critical issue here at the table. If that is not an improvement over the current structure, as I recall the testimony from Pedro Van Meers, he referenced the dysfunctionality of HB 110. Starting with cost allocation issues, not starting with it, but one of the big issues was how do you allocate cost amongst different hydrocarbon streams when you try to incentivize heavy oil or viscous or whatever you're going to try to do, target. And it's a lot cleaner to stay away from the concept of cost allocation by moving the progressivity on the growth so you don't have to do the cost allocations. So that runs just, 180 out from our testimony from at least two consultants that have reviewed this. Also, there's been no discussion on the linkage, the delinkage of oil and gas, which would substantially thicken the bill if we had to delink oil and gas, because under our current structure, we'd be losing about $2 billion a year if we ran a 4.5 BCF line. So what's your opinion on the delinking of oil and gas, or should we go back and link that and have the state face a $2 billion loss?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't think that we should, but there's no doubt in my mind, just as there's no doubt in all of our minds that if the price of oil dropped to $40 a barrel for an extended period of time, there would be changes and tough decisions to be made. There's no doubt in my mind that they will be delinked before a major gas sale, considering we don't even know when a major gas sale is going to occur. And that's something we've worked with you on, Mr. Chairman, and I agree this does do that, but there are other ways to do that. This isn't the one and only way to decouple.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you, but I think there is some risk exposure the state has with the linkage of oil and gas in the first open season dealing with the GEA. I don't think that door's been closed. We're trying to get a definitive answer from the administration on that exposure. And as far as I know to this date, and I haven't talked with Senator Pascavan, who's been writing the letters lately, but I don't think that's been definitively defined yet. And until it is, I would operate under the conclusion that we have some significant financial exposure until told otherwise by the Department of Law.
The Department of Law has told us that door has been closed, and I'll make sure that you get the information that I believe that we had already sent out, but we'll make sure you get a copy of that letter.
That could be, but okay. We'll go to Senator McGuire and then Senator Hope.
Thank you, through the chair. Just on this broader conversation about gas, I would like to hear a little bit more. And when the companies come forward that have been meeting the benchmarks, moving toward a gas line under a GEA, how much of the conversation has centered around the ability to write off costs associated with gas. I do think that there has been a significant advantage to the linking within the system for those companies, and whether it's the very small issue per se, not small but narrow issue of a rate is one thing, a rate being negotiated and decoupling to occur to set that rate. But I think another issue is the cost and how that has factored in to their willingness in Point Thompson and other areas to sort of explore this notion of a gas line, which might otherwise be uneconomic. So I'd like to hear a little bit more if you have thoughts on that, and certainly from Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips, because I think that's something Alaskans are really looking to see. And then the final point I want to ask you about, and then those that come forward, is on Cook Inlet, which is near and dear to my heart and to my people, who joined the rest of the state in an energy crisis a couple of years ago. We went through rolling blackouts and other things. Myself and Senator Wagner worked very hard on a piece of legislation, Senate Bill 309, that was designed to incentivize drilling in that area, and lo and behold, we've done it. But that's not all that happens, because the players that can write their costs off in Cook Inlet certainly, I think, have been more prone to invest in that area. So I have some concerns myself when I sit back and think about what impact there will be to disincentivize investment in Cook Inlet and certainly in the areas that lead up to the gas line. I'd appreciate your comment.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire. Yeah, I'm certainly aware of that issue. I don't have specific insight from the companies on what role that would play, other than being aware of, you know, the idea that between now and when there's going to be a major gas sale, that there's going to be a lot of work done on gas fiscals. And Governor Parnell has pointed out that he hopes or anticipates that the 2013 session can be a gas fiscal session, where we're going to be fleshing through a lot of these issues. And hopefully, if things progress like they potentially could through this calendar year, that is something that we'll be digging into.
And just to follow up, you're correct that the interplay between Cook Inlet and North Slope and the companies that own portions in both, and how those interplay with the tax system, and how that works under a net system, how it used to work under a gross system. We're now going to a hybrid gross and net system. This goes back to what the commissioner started to hit on earlier, was how this affects the Department of Revenue, how this affects the state. We continually hear about how the state's outgunned. We're outmanned. Private sector can pay more. They can gear up quicker. They have more resources to throw at problems such as this. We're now in a position where we've been under a tax system, the same tax system, for five years. And speaking with the folks that have to deal with this tax structure, ACEs, on a day-in and day-out basis, they understand it. Our auditors understand it. We have very smart people that are working this system. As a good example, Repsol was calling us to find out how our tax system worked. And we had a lot of conversations with them explaining it to them. But we're now in a position where we're on equal footing. We understand the system as well, if not better, than the private sector. And I think by overhauling the system again, we may be taking a step back, because we're going to have to start over. We've implemented over 70 regs just to get to where we are today, and we're kind of closing the regulation schedule right now. We're going to have to, and I'm not saying we're going to throw 70 regs out and start from reg one, but we're going to have to analyze all the regs and how they interplay with each other. So I think from a personal perspective of how this affects the folks that have to implement changes that come out of the legislature, we're in a position now where we've been dealing with this for several years and we understand it. And the point of HB 110 was to work within the system. And again, there's a lot of moving parts, and if tax credits are an issue to some folks, there we could look at tax credits, and there are a lot of tax credits to work on. And you can turn knobs significantly on that tax credit for several different results. But the point from our perspective, and this is dealing with the people that have to implement it, it's better to deal with the system in place and work on that. So that's just my own personal perspective.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. So I think what I now, I think I'm understanding when you were dialoguing with the chairman about the complexity of the system and the potential statement that this would make life more complicated than ACEs, I think you've clarified that. Your point is that in creating sort of a dual tax system, one allowing for the progressivity on the gross, if you will, that that's really where now your workers are going to have to assess sort of two different things. You've got net, you've got gross, and then progressivity on that feature. Is that correct?
That, through the chair, Senator McGuire, that is correct. So if a tax change, a structure change is passed by this body, we'll figure it out, we'll get on top of it, and we'll catch up, and we will work with it. If changing the structure is the main issue and tweaking the knobs within the new structure, it's, you know, we have smart people on board and we'll figure it out. But I'm saying today, under the existing structure, we've already caught up and we are on equal playing field, and we do understand the system that we're dealing with now to great detail, greater than most of the companies that are coming into the state, certainly. So that's kind of the complexity of ACEs versus this. That's what we were referring to.
Okay. Just before I go to Senator Hoffman, just a quick thing. I think there's a huge difference between going from a tax and royalty system to a concession system under PPT, modifying it under ACEs. That's a huge magnitude difference between taking progressivity from the net, flipping it to the gross, when your main calculation is how much oil's come out of the ground, how much that oil is allocated to royalties, and multiply it by a formula. So I hear what you're saying. I just don't believe you, to be quite frank. Not counting the information system. I recognize that that is a piece of complexity. But, you know, and we can talk about that complexity issues, and maybe I just don't understand it. But I just have a hard time buying it. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the same topic on bullet point four, the burden to the department, could a portion of that burden be lifted if we, say, delayed the effective date some, so giving you more time, or delay portions of the bill so that the burden would not be so burdensome, giving you more time to implement?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that would be a benefit. However, as we're looking at everything we have on our plate, including a 2 to 5 year period of trying to implement this tax database system, it's still a huge lift for a department that has a minimal amount of involvement in this information in the first place.
And just to add a little bit to that, a couple presentations ago, we did present a four-page schematic of the 35 pieces of information that we're looking for in 192, and we collect, DNR, AOGCC, collect a lot of that information already. And I think what we're looking at here is the TRMS system that we're working to get going is going to replace spreadsheets and PDFs, a very antiquated system. So that's a big lift to get that going. PIMS would be dealing with the exact same data set, spreadsheets, PDFs, et cetera. So what we're saying is we need to catch up on the TRMS system. A lot of work that's going to go into that will feed into other types of things like this that will be able to produce reports and things that will be beneficial to the public. So I think what we're saying is we've got a huge lift in front of us right now for the TRMS system, and the PIMS would be using the same data set, more or less, just trying to produce it, and the output would be different. So we think if we can get going on TRMS and see some progress there, we can go down this road that you're trying to get to in PIMS. And, you know, ideal world, during PPT when that was dropped in, you know, we were working on a database from day one. That's not the way it happened. We're starting here. We've got a year under our belt going down this road. So we do see a lot of positive coming out the TRMS that could lead into something along these lines.
Senator Hoffman, do you have a question? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Believe me, it was not our intent to create some huge worthless system, and we appreciated your response to the initial, our reaction to at least to the initial request or requirements of that. Most of our concern came from not receiving maybe accurate information, or had different information coming from different departments, depending on who you talked to, and wanted to have more of a coordination of that activity, thinking that was a reasonable thing to do. And it's not unique to your system or your department. I found pretty much throughout the state that almost everybody's system is antiquated. Regardless, we could take it out of the realm here and just talk about other systems, and that is as much a concern as it is with you folks, and that's why the money was appropriated last year to get the system going. And it's somewhat discouraging, though, to ask one department a question and get an answer, and ask another department a question and get a somewhat different answer. So it seemed to us that if we were going to move forward in a uniform manner and try and have people working together, that it was reasonable to, you know, put this request forward. And like I said, it's unfortunate you've reacted to it this way, that it would be create all this work. We certainly knew that it would be creating some work, but we hope with the new system that you would be able to automate things to a point that it would be helpful and accurate, and that you would be able to collect that other information from other departments and coordinate and make a simpler process, which would lead to better tax understandings, better auditing performance, and things such as that. So it was not intended to create a lot of work for you, at least from my opinion.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I appreciate that, and we are digging into it right now and trying to come up with a fiscal number. When we talked to Kathy Forrester at AOGCC, when they would have put it together, she told us, and I don't know what the fiscal note said, but she told us that her estimate was $36 million and I think 10 or 12 positions. We don't know that it's going to be that with us, but it's substantial, and the more we dig into it in terms of trying to get different systems and different databases and different forms all together, kind of the more complicated it gets. But we'll try to get an estimate to you as quickly as we can.
And just as one quick follow-up through the chair, Senator Thomas, we have been working a lot with Kathy Forrester at AOGCC, Director Barron at Department of or Division of Oil and Gas, because as we have spent the last year working on the TRMS system, and we recognize that companies are providing information to several different departments and divisions in different formats because that's what they have to do, and that's the system that's in place, unfortunately. So we have been coordinating with these other folks to see what portals they're using to collect this information, because we don't want to create a bunch of different ways to do this. Ultimately, we'd like to see everything coming in one portal, and then it's divvied out, you know, confidential, non-confidential, what have you. So that is our goal, and we have been working very closely with Oil and Gas and with AOGCC to ultimately get to that point. So we do have the same vision, I think.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I guess one of the concerns that I have relating to gas is that yesterday in the committee that I chair, we heard HB9, and I realize it's not a major sale, but it's a line that's coming down on the ASAP route that's sponsored by the speaker. And he's talking about having an open season that's going to be starting on January 1st, 2013, which if we don't have things in order, I don't see how anybody could even bid on an open season without having an idea on what they're going to go and have as a tax rate. So I guess that's the concern that I have, and especially if you start dealing with the possibility of putting an LNG plant for export either down on the Kenai or someplace down that way. So,
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that's a good point. There have already been two pipelines that have had open seasons, but we've heard from the very beginning that you can have an open season, but getting to a point where a project would be sanctioned, there needs to be a working between the state and companies at taking a look at the gas fiscals far beyond just a coupling. There's got to be a lot of work done on that, and that work hopefully we can get done sooner rather than later.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, back to the first bullet here. I'd like you to get back to the committee, because in the beginning of your sentence, this is changes move in the wrong direction. So I'd like to see some calculations showing the deterioration of the economics with a lower tax rate. I want to see the full cycle economics run, and I want to see the FY13 numbers run.
relative to our current system. And it says it discourages investments. I assume if those numerics show that these tax rates are higher than ACES, I would agree with you, we're going in the wrong direction. And if they're lower, then I think you may want to reevaluate that to some extent, and then encourages harvest mode. We've had a lot of testimony that we're in harvest mode. And if we want to get out of harvest mode or encourage the industry to move away from harvest mode, there needs to be some changes. So I'd like to know how it encourages, how improving the economics for the industry encourages harvest mode. And if you could put that in economic terms, I want to see the economics run and the models so we can adjust this bill then so we actually have a lower tax rate than ACES. I'm under the impression that we already do in front of us.
Mr. Chairman, we don't have the specifics of the variables of your full cycle, but we're happy to work with Mr. Peterson and do that. What we were basing that on is the fact that when you move from a net to a part net, part gross, that high cost developments are going to benefit to a smaller degree than they currently do in many high cost situations, which is what we were trying to point out on slide 12. And if I could, Mr. Chairman, before we wrap up, I just wanted to point out that as we were analyzing the bill last night, the Department of Law pointed out a potential constitutionality issues on equal taxing of different companies. We didn't get any more specifics than that, but we'll have the Department of Law contact Ledge Legal and Mr. Peterson on that. And there were also a couple of little tweaks in the technical aspects of new field definition that we'll talk to you about.
Yeah, that's a new one, this constitutional issue. So if there's a concern, Department of Law, then get it to our office and we'll figure out what it is and work on the drafting or whatever.
We'll work
with you guys on that. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we could revert back to slide number 3, the second bullet point. And I guess, you know, everything is sort of relative, but, you know, I would look at $170 a barrel. So does this bill make Alaska more appealing to potential investors if the price of oil was at $170 a barrel?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, yes, it would, but world history has never seen $170 a barrel, which isn't to say that's not something we should be taking into account, but it's certainly not something we should be focusing, in my opinion, focusing our decisions on.
Well, world history didn't, 4 years ago, didn't predict $145 a barrel oil either.
That is correct, Senator, and then a drop off to $37 right
so,
after.
So when does it, when, at what dollar level, if you said it could be at 170, is it appealing at 160, 150? When does it become appealing? When does this bill become appealing? At what price level of oil?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, those are for the companies to give you insight on. It's all proprietary information, so a company's not going to tell you specifically in their economic model what they're basing their decisions on, but just the information we've received, it's been a more conservative number, 70, 80, 90. I mean, they're certainly aware of what would happen in a situation at high oil prices, but I don't think they make decisions whether to invest or not invest based on 170 as opposed to, say, 70, which is far more likely to be seen if history is any guide than 170.
So I think it's all relative. You know, if you say it's appealing at $170 a barrel, overall I think it's all on probabilities of what the price of oil is going to be. But overall, your answer to this bill in its current form, does this bill make Alaska more appealing to potential investors? Your answer is no?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I'll let the companies answer that question.
Well, you put it in here for consideration of questions. You know, I just was wondering what you're saying that HB 110, it's yes, and now you're saying you don't want to say yes or no to this particular bill, but you're willing to say yes to 110?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Hoffman, these are questions that we considered, the administration considered as we worked on a bill, and we believe they've said yes because they've come up with commitments that not just that it's a material change that will affect their positively affect their investment decisions, but also they have mentioned dollar amounts for that, and they may very well do it for this bill. I do not know. That's why I can't answer.
I don't buy the line that they made commitments. I think we need to be a little bit more accurate at the table here. They've expressed some interest. My understanding, it takes all three companies, the three majors, to agree. And until I see a letter with all three of them signing it, I don't think it's much of a commitment. So if somebody's got a commitment out there, I'd like to have it delivered to my office.
Chairman Stedman, and I think DNR can be a lot more specific, but not all investments on the North Slope would require all three. I believe there's some areas of the North Slope where only two of the companies are required to give their approval. So it's not a blanket. All three have to agree to invest any dollars. There are specific regions.
Right. And then just as a clarification, again, on the magnitude of the $5 million, we've had testimony it's going to take $3 to $5 million a year, billion a year, not $5 billion over 7 or 8 or 10 years.
Which
so
really,
quite frankly, you couldn't even see it in the analysis hardly, a $5 billion, unless you have a multiple years running in a row to try to drive that production curve up.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I agree with that. And we've heard $5 billion, we've heard $9 billion, we've heard other companies that aren't going to say but view it as a material difference. I mean, ultimately, I don't think we're going to know until it's passed or not. The question is, are we going to pass a bill that is positively viewed as material and moving the needle or not? That's the view we've taken of it, because a tax reduction bill that results in no new investment or development didn't achieve what it was hoping to achieve.
Right, and then just in closing, we'll move on. We'll take a brief break here, but
one more question.
Go ahead.
Thank you. If you can't answer number two on slide three, does that mean you can't answer question number one either?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I once again don't want to, I can certainly see the problems a potential investor would have in making the situation more complex initially, but I can't speak for the companies about the specific economics of it.
Just in closing, you know, at $120 a barrel, which is pretty close to where we're at, this bill moves about $277 million across the table in FY13 numbers. HB 110 moves $2 billion. There's more money to the industry in the tax change than there is in incremental drilling. And I'd like to see some economics that show that that is in fact not true, that you can derive incremental production that overwhelms this. So I think the drive here is for more of a tax change than the benefit of the incremental drilling in the bottom line dollars. Someday I'd like to see the analysis to show that that initial review of these numbers are incorrect. But it would take a substantial amount of enhanced oil recovery to make a $2 billion net swing to the Treasury per year. $20 billion in 20 years, and they'd be into it, I don't know, $8, $10 billion before they started turning the oil on. With that, we're going to take a recess, and we'll have BP next. Come back on the record. I misspoke before we went to recess. I was so excited to get to recess. BP is the third presenter. The second presenter today is the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And if Kara Moriarity,
executive director can introduce herself.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman. On behalf of the member companies of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, or commonly referred to as AOGA, who account for the majority of the oil and gas exploration, production, transportation, refining, and marketing activities in this state, I would like to offer the following comments regarding work draft version O, which we prepared comments for based around last night, of the Senate Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 192. Despite the diversity of my membership that I have spoken of before, my comments do reflect a 100% consensus among my member companies. 3 weeks ago today, on March 16th, we testified to you about the Senate Resources version of 192. At that time, we told you that unless one is satisfied to see North Slope oil production continue to decline at about 6% a year or more, meaningful changes need to be made to the present ACES tax. We pointed out a number of measures that the Resources CS could have taken but didn't, as well as a number of things that it proposed to do that would have been counterproductive. Despite all of your time and effort that has gone into Work Draft O, we have to say as AOGA that this new CS also falls short of the meaningful tax change that is called for in order to meet the challenge of stopping decline, much less the even harder goal of getting back to 1 million barrels a day flowing through the TAPS oil pipeline. The CS does indeed provide a slightly less onerous tax treatment for new fields and increases in production. But we would remind you, and I think you mentioned it earlier, Senator, that the two very new fields, Ugarik and Nikaichuk, are expected to peak at about 20,000 barrels per day. This year, the North Slope, at a 6% decline, will decline by roughly 40,000 barrels a day, as much as these two new fields combined. So in other words, to just offset the decline, two new fields like Ugarik and Nikaichuk would need to come into production each year. These slight improvements to the tax system are not likely to generate this level of development from new fields. The producers of the existing non-legacy fields on the slope and the developers of any new fields that may be discovered need as much production as possible flowing from the legacy fields through the TAPS oil pipeline in order to keep the cost affordable to ship their oil from the slope to its refinery destinations. Unaffordably high transportation costs could cripple the economics of any new fields that might be found, as well as the economics of non-legacy fields currently in production. So, in other words, the North Slope oil province is much like a tree, with the two great legacy fields being its trunk, and with the other fields being branches rising out of the trunk. If one peels the bark off all the way around the trunk and make it unhealthy, all the other branches will become unhealthy too, no matter how robust they might have been if the trunk had stayed strong. It has been openly acknowledged today and during the committee's hearings that the intent is to keep the tax essentially the same as the present tax for the legacy fields at about $100 barrel oil. And Work Draft O reflects that intent. But that intent is just the opposite of what we urged in our March 16th testimony on the Resources CS, and it is the opposite of what we urge you to do now. Throughout the 27th legislature, AOGA and others have been testifying about what is happening with their businesses on the North Slope, about the interrelationship between the level of new investment each year and the rate of decline in Alaska North Slope production, and about the effects taxes have on investment decisions. These explanations are not threats, but they're not bluffs either. They have been candid attempts to describe to you how companies evaluate their investment opportunities here against their opportunities elsewhere, and how Alaska's tax regime can influence the decisions about which opportunities to take. Those decisions reflect the expectations of the company's respective shareholders that each company will choose the opportunities that it perceives to be the best, all things considered, including taxes. If an Alaskan opportunity is better than one elsewhere, and there is enough budgeted money for only one of them, the shareholders expect, and in a very real sense demand, that the Alaska opportunity be taken. The reductions in the levels of companies' investments in Alaska since the enactment of ACES are not any kind of retaliation for ACES' enactment, nor does a company cut back simply just to spite its face. The investments are nothing more and nothing less than the result of the competition of the Alaskan opportunities against opportunities elsewhere. Anyone is free to believe that the declining investments and declining production on the North Slope are due to something other than those reasons, but they would be mistaken. Unfortunately, by the time they are proven to be mistaken, the opportunity for Alaska to have addressed the situation will have passed, and there aren't any do-overs. So, without meaningful tax relief for the legacy fields, as well as the other production, the bark of this tree will continue to be peeled off the tree trunk, harming the entire tree, harming the entire North Slope. Work Draft O threatens harm for every member of AOGA. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Senate Finance Committee for this opportunity to share our deep and grave concerns with this current work draft. We respectfully ask you to take another look at what it would do and to replace it with a CS that would provide a meaningful tax change to enable the additional investments the state needs for a healthy economic future. In closing, I want to reemphasize that these comments have the unanimous support of AOGA members, which are Apache, BP, Chevron, Eni Petroleum, ExxonMobil, Flint Hills, Hillcorp, Marathon, PetroStar, Pioneer, Repsol, Shell, Statoil, Tesoro, XTO, and the Alaska Pipeline Service Company. I appreciate this opportunity, Mr. Chairman, and I'm happy to try and answer any questions that you or the committee may have.
I think one of the challenges we have is the definition of meaningful, and they also use commonly significant. At $120 a barrel, moving $277 million across the table to a lot of people is meaningful and significant. Someone else's interpretation could be the $2 billion, which is HB 110. So it makes it difficult to define that term. So can you help us define that term?
Mr. Chairman, obviously I represent a diverse group of oil companies. So meaningful is going to have different terms for even every one of my member companies. What I can tell you is after our evaluation, none of my member companies thought this would improve their competitiveness evaluating Alaska projects versus their projects against anywhere elsewhere in their portfolio. So we believe that the changes such as bracketing would do in progressivity would get us on a more competitive playing field.
Yeah, I think just as a clarification, the bracketing issue is just a mechanism to shift cash from one side to the other side of the table.
We view that as a more substantial change in progressivity than what is being proposed here today.
And I would agree it is more substantial as far as the magnitude of shifting the cash at $100 or $120 a barrel. Even if you go up to $200 a barrel, we would shift $2.6 billion versus $4.4 billion. So all along the way, north of 100, there's more shifting of cash to the other side of the table, meaning to the industry side, north of about $60, because we have the floor in here, so it's a little bit different, but clearly under all price ranges. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your presentation. Appreciate hearing your thoughts on it. But one of the issues I think that always is brought up is the commitments end of thing, and I think that's probably to me, and I can't speak for others on the committee, I can only speak for myself, I think the commitment end of it is extremely important. We could probably structure a tax system that, depending on commitments and going forward to try and accomplish those commitments, although we would not expect somebody to guarantee us something would happen, but if in fact there was a more of a business relationship that had been discussed and reached where X would take place if Y happened, and at this point in time we were discussing a number of projects that had been in place before ACES or things that could be done that had been considered at this point in time going forward, that we would probably be in a very different situation of understanding meaningful and commitments, and that you could make an arrangement at that point in time that if in fact those commitments were carried forward with to the various companies on a frame of several years of what would take place, recognizing as we certainly do the amount of investment that needs to take place to even stabilize, much less increase the amounts of production, that a tax structure could have been put in place that would say, you go back and get these commitments from your company to expend this money in this area, and the tax will then be effective at that point in time. It's simply language to put things in place. And I think that's where we have all fallen short of trying to get a better understanding of what would take place in the future, and that does not helpful to the process. So just a comment, not necessarily a question.
Have any other questions? With the bells have rung, so seeing no other questions, I think thank you, Kara, for coming in. I think what we'll do, rather than have BP start and only get like 3 minutes into it, even though they only got a couple slides, I think we'll just start them at 1 o'clock, because I'm sure there'll be some discussion as they are the major, or they are the operator and are one of the top 10 most prolific oil fields on the planet that are known as Prudhoe Bay. We're adjourned.